You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Taking up the story from the knowledge that we seek,
broadening horizons into ear. Hello and welcome to Modern Myth. My name is Tristan and I am your wonderful host. Today's episode, we are talking to the author of the book, Every Monument Will Fall. I am talking, of course, with Dr. Dan Hicks, who is a professor of contemporary archaeology at the University of Oxford. Thank you very much for coming to speak to me today.
It's wonderful to be here, Tristan. Good to talk to you. We talked 4 years ago, I think, about my last book, and it's a joy to be back here to talk about the new one.
Exactly. And we're just having a conversation about pronunciation. It is the Prutish Museums that was the last book that was released, talking about things about repatriation and things, and talking specifically about case studies. What's interesting is with Every Monument Will Fall, with the title, I think you've chosen, I wouldn't call it a clickbaity title, but it is definitely a title that can get the conversation started. Why this title, though?
Yeah, so obviously, as the book argues, the unfallen status of the Cecil Rhodes Monument in Oxford at Oriel College is the immediate context for writing from Oxford about these issues that affect institutions, communities, cities around the world, which is how we deal with a certain form of monumentality that was invented in, it turns out, a fairly sort of tight period of time between, let's say, the 1870s and the 1920s, a sort of, if you like, a proto-fascist history of sort of monuments from the American Civil War through to monuments in the UK, but also to many monuments across the continent of Africa, across sort of European empires, and across Europe. So in the summer of 2020, the banners read, "All the monuments must fall." And in some ways, absolutely supporting the movement of fallism on a case-by-case sort of basis, this book looks at the choices we make as societies, institutions, communities. And so Every Monument Will Fall is simply to observe that unless we keep a monument up, it isn't going to last forever. So we can reshape our memory culture, or something that that's happening all the time in every society, every community around the world. We're making a decision to keep things, and we're making a decision about what we don't keep, who we remember and who we don't.
It's interesting with this book in particular that I was really interested by the choices that you've made and how to describe it, because it's not really the same kind of typical kind of like very divorced, like separated facts on the ground, just presenting stuff. You've woven a kind of a personal narrative through the book.
Yeah.
What was the reason for you writing in a kind to bring that personal narrative in? What was the thinking behind that?
Yeah, so it is absolutely written in a very different way to the British Museums. And in some ways, it's a mode of writing which, you know, took a long time to find in terms of voice, in terms of tone, because this is not only the history of who gets remembered, of the dead white men who are memorialized in stone or metal, was the general on the horse, or the Cecil Rhodes image at Oriel College, who wears the business suit of the businessman but holds in his right hand the slouch hat of the imperial yeomanry. He might as well be holding a machine gun, really, for all of what that iconography means about the connections in between corporate colonialism and militarist violence. But it's also about who gets forgotten, erased, dehumanized, has their body, not their image, but actually in some cases their physical bodies posthumously abused by these institutions. And in the case of the history that I tell in this story, it is about the history of a woman's body, which is abused at a different Oxford college, at the Worcester College, Oxford. And we can get into that history. But the point is how to tell a history of that kind, how to try to give a voice to someone who was renamed or written out of history on the one side, but other people whose names are foregrounded. That involves a lot of thought about how, essentially, by telling the story, you're not just going to make things worse. You're not just going to reinscribe the violence or recenter Augustus Pitt Rivers after the archaeologist and soldier after whom the museum in which I work is named, or Cecil Rhodes. We've said their names already several times in our short conversation so far. How do you, who gets named and who doesn't? So that was the reason to just think about voice, and in some cases actually move from the first person into the second person. So a lot of this book is written in what you might call the vocative. And the vocative or the invocative is the voice in which you might address the dead, or you might say a prayer. But that use of the second person, hopefully over time, there are certain people to whom this book is addressed. But also, I hope at the end of the, by the time you reach the end of the book, that the second person also manages to encompass the reader. So it isn't an us and them, it isn't a me and you, it's a you which expands into thinking about the second person in that way. So it's an attempt really to decenter myself, but also to decenter Rhodes and sort of Pitt Rivers and all those men that when we write these histories, we can end up just endlessly repeating the names of the curator and the major general who did the looting and the racial fake racial scientist that invented sort of eugenics and all that stuff. What happens if we try to recenter other voices, other ideas, other theorists, other names, other histories?
And obviously, as you touched on there, the kind of point that people really think about most recently with falling statues is obviously the statue of Edgar Colson, which was defaced and torn down and thrown into the river in Bristol. You actually, at the time, I think you wrote about that as well. How do you feel, like, looking back now, almost like 4 or 5 years on, do you feel that that was just a flash in the pan? Or do you think that kind of moment actually has created at least the start of a change?
So let's not see it as a moment, and let's not see that moment as happening in 2020. I'm old enough to remember attending events about the removal of Edward Colston in the late 1990s when I lived in Bristol. It was a movement to remove Colston that had a long history. And it was my generation that by the time you got to 2005 and you got to the 200-year anniversary of abolition in 2007, my generation felt that we'd failed in going through the formal sort of process of what, you know, then was with English Heritage and the local planning process. It was obvious that the community and the city wanted this memorial to be removed. But it simply turned out to be impossible because there was, every time you attempted to make a change, there was a block somewhere along the line. So the fact that eventually the monument fall, I've obviously thought a lot about that because it took 35 or 40 years for Colston to fall. Remember, he lived in the 17th century, early 18th century. By the time that image went up in 1895, he'd been dead for longer than he'd been alive. So this is not the man, it's not about the man, it's about the memorial. It's about a form of memorialization, or as I say in the book, a form of monumentality that seeks to mix up the monument and the man. So as soon as the monument is erected at the harbour to commemorate in the 1890s, that sense of that the city would want to celebrate and in labor at that point. That is absolutely a decision about sort of memory culture and it being reshaped. I think the really hopeful bit of the book is that I've pointed out that whether it's campaigns over Civil War monuments, as I talk about Oxford in North Carolina, whether it's the long history of the fallism movement in African and indigenous contexts since the middle of the 20th century, or indeed whether it's in the falling of Cecil Rhodes, who has fallen in Zambia, Zimbabwe, South Africa over the years, that it just takes a little time for a monument to fall. It maybe takes 30, 40, 50 years in some cases, but eventually in those intergenerational movements, memory culture does shift when that's what a community wants. So I think that's the real hope, is that these are where we're now 10 years entering the second a decade of the Rhodes Must Fall Oxford campaign. But in many cities, your listeners around the world will think about how near they are right this moment from a monument or a statue, which has been under debate for some time and hasn't fallen. But equally, as the book says, also not just those images of people, but also the physical ancestral remains that are hidden away in the museums as well. And again, there's a sense that those ancestors will never be returned. Those different histories of who gets remembered and who doesn't, who we are, what does sort of dignity look like, what does consent look like in these forms of sort of memory culture, that's really what the book's about. But the hopeful bit is that as long as those intergenerational movements happen, then any society is able to reshape its memory culture. Memory culture is not a term that we use all that much in the UK or in English, but obviously in a German context, Erinnerungskultur, the culture of memory, has a long history of being debated, and in other cultures as well. Fundamentally, the Fallism movement is a long-standing African and indigenous-led movement that has a long history, though. So every time, it's a bit like restitution. Every time someone talks about returning the Benin bronzes, every generational conversation, there's an attempt to go back to first principles as if no one's ever had this conversation before. Whereas, of course, restitution has a long history that reaches back to the 1950s, 1930s. It's the same for Fallism. These are long-term movement. So that's that history, that prehistory of Fallism, but also in some cases the prehistory of what people call the culture war, was at the heart of what this book's about.
I think as a millennial who grew up where I was transitioning from primary school to secondary school around 9/11 and then subsequently the Iraq invasion, I think for someone like myself, when I think the most striking example of a statue being toppled as a huge spectacle is that of the statues of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And that is obviously in the context of like conquest, of war, of military. And obviously it's almost like I could see people taking that as the typeset of this is what it means to topple a statue is in an act of conquest and war and this kind of overwriting of the past. Not to say that like these things are equal, but that Fallism is like that's an aspect of it. It's more to say that, like you said, there's a lot of history to these kind of things, and I think what happens sometimes is that it's the striking memories that people have personally that kind of inform them. I think that's the same with the culture war, really, is that you find that I'm sure I can find the study, but basically, for example, in the UK, the people who are most in favor of strict immigration are people who live with the least percentage of of non-white British people. You know what I mean? There's this kind of juxtaposition there that kind of is calling to some other kind of nationalistic identity.
Yeah, exactly. So I think in all of these conversations, whether it's about restitution or about Fallism, and in many ways what this book does is it seeks to apply what I've learned about restitution to the question of Fallism and to wider questions over decolonization. The risks are always twofold. There is the risk of whataboutism, and there's the risk of where will it endism. So the idea that people want to remove a monument or to change, you know, their built environment, their historic built environment. There are more than 20,000 applications for listed building consent, you know, in England alone every year, which are successful and are approved. And in many cases, that includes the demolition of historic buildings. The world is constantly changing. And so the question is how you manage that change. So rather than the where will it endism or the whataboutism, let's talk about this issue, that issue, I was interested in the phenomenon to which the three grassroots movements, which have really impinged upon my working life, and where there have been literally protests outside the museum, there have been calls for changes in the policies of sort of museums, but also the wider issues over archaeology and anthropology as disciplines. They're threefold. They are the Fallism movement, as it's emerged in Algeria, in what used to be Rhodesia, across the American South, from the middle of the 20th century, and indeed in some cases earlier. So the Fallism movement for statues, the restitution movement, which has a similar history and again across Africa, across indigenous communities, for the return of ancestral human remains, for the return of sort of cultural objects that were looted, but also third, the call for the decolonization of knowledge. So that happens not in the museums or for statues, but in seminar rooms and libraries, and actually in podcast spaces like this one, where we're talking about what I call the four A's: archaeology, anthropology, art, and architecture, the fields in which I work. You know that a lot of people listening to this will understand the links in between those fields, but those links have a history. So all of those movements, the Fallism movement and the restitution movement and the movement for the decolonization of knowledge, seem to me are reacting to a similar impulse, a common history that emerged in between the 1870s and the 1920s, which is, it's about the founding of anthropology and archaeology as disciplines, the use of monuments in order to seek to naturalize sort of ideas over cultural supremacy, but also the looting of objects and the putting of them into museums. And so what in the book I call militarist realism is that art movement which worked across ideas and monuments and museums in that way, to which it seems to me all of these movements are reacting. So I was really interested in, you mentioned the culture war, I'm interested in the idea, that idea of a culture war, that framing has a history. It's maybe even got a prehistory. And it turns out that maybe it isn't a culture war. It's a history of a war on culture, a history of an attempt to use culture as a weapon for telling stories over cultural supremacy.
I think you can bring that to light in the hypocrisy of what statues can fall without much deliberation. I always find it very telling that while there seems to be a lot of noise made about statues like Edward Colson, Cecil Rhodes, or those kind of people, there didn't seem to be any pushback for the removal of the Jimmy Savile statue in Glasgow. There seemed to be a kind of reticence to engage with that removal of statue. Why should that not be us forgetting history? You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I what it really portrays to it portrays the idea that actually, no, if you don't mind that these people were slavers, that doesn't bother you. You know what I mean? That's what it says to me, is that somebody sees the symbolic man, not the person themselves, but like you said, the memorial as a symbol, not of that person themselves, but of obviously like a kind of British imperialism, but a kind of nostalgic British imperialism. And for me, it's almost speaking out both sides of your mouth when you're saying that, oh no, we should remember what contributions they've made. And at the same time, so they weren't that bad. You know what I mean? It feels very hypocritical.
Well, it does.
To engage it in one over the other.
Exactly. Exactly. So on the one side, what I'd say, on the one side, there's been an attempt to re-stoke or to re-fight, have the last gasp of this long-standing culture war that has been going on from the late 19th century, which was part of how these monuments were erected in the first place. Because a lot of them, as I say, were not erected at the time. They were erected actually in the 1880s, 1890s, or the early part of the 1900s. But also, ultimately, there were always, I spent a long time in sort of heritage management in the commercial archaeology world, working for local authorities. Heritage management is all about the management of change and the fact that some things are going to be removed and some things aren't. And we saw that that came into really sharp focus for me when we had, I don't know if you remember, the culture minister we had in the UK called Nadine. But let's just remember, maybe about the time that we were talking to each other last, back in 2021, when she came into office in the September of 2021, one of her first actions was to emergency unlist a building, a monument that had been emergency listed on the expert guidance of Historic England, which was a site called the Dorman Long Tower on Teesside. And within 36 hours, this industrial monument of the middle of the 20th century that was so iconic for many people who had links to the mining community and industrial heritage of the northeast of England, it was dynamited, right? Because there was a decision that, no, this is not something that should be kept, even though that listing was the product of active grassroots campaigning and the expert advice of Historic England. Within a couple of months later, the same person, Dorries, had emergency listed, again, against the guidance of Historic England, not the Rhodes Monument in Oxford, but around the corner, this sort of memorial to where he had his digs as an undergraduate, which went up in 1904, which is by no means, the experts had said, absolutely not, this is not worth listing. There had been a campaign to remove the other monument, and it was expected that the college was going to remove this small brass sort of plaque that no one had even noticed for 100 years. But there she decided against, again, against what the community wanted, that was going to be kept. What that underlines is that we are always making decisions about what is kept and what is not. What we need is an openness and a transparency about the about how those sort of decisions are made. Is this going to be by the fiat of a culture minister acting in a sort of a Trumpian way about, here's my letter that says this is what's got to happen? Or are we going to have a reshaping of our heritage and thereby our cultures of memory, where we can say, actually, we're going to decide whether we want to remember industrial heritage or whether we want to remember colonial heritage. For me, this was personal because I come from a long line of coal miners. My father was a coal miner in the northeast of England, his father before him. His father, my grandfather, worked at a colliery in the 1920s that Dorman Long took over. So the Dorman Long Tower for me was a was an icon of a name of a part of industrial heritage, so much has been of which has been lost, which was part of my family history. Equally, the Rhodes Monument was a part of my workplace. And so for me, again, it was very much these were both communities I was part of, and you just saw that those interventions as being fundamentally undemocratic and the reshaping to say, we're going to remember certain aspects of empire and we're not going to remember industrial heritage. So that for me was a really important lesson in sort of 2021 to 22 that was a really important sort of impetus for writing this book.
And we'll further discuss the effect of British imperialism in history in our next segment. Hi, you're listening to Modern Myth here with Tristan Boyle, and my guest is Dr. Dan Hicks, whose book, Every Monument Will Fall, is now available to buy from bookshops. And we were just discussing the kind of, about statues, about the kind of, the ways in which things like anthropology, art, archaeology, and architecture are the key components of how we see the past and what the book covers. And I think now I want to move on to another subject that is talked about in this book and actually got a bit of coverage as well, which is this skull, this cup made from the skull of an enslaved person that was being used as a kind of ceremonial drinking vessel up until, is it 2015?
2015.
It's ridiculous. So
exactly. In an Oxford college, we should say, in a college of the University of Oxford, over dessert after formal dinners.
What do we know about this object and its kind of provenance? How did it even end up in the Oxford college?
Exactly. And so it's a, I think let's talk about this as a person, as a human being, rather than an object. And I think one of the big themes of this book is about how this history, this surprisingly recent history from the late 19th, early 20th century of forms of colonial thinking that found their way right into the heart of the establishment in London, Oxford, Cambridge, wherever. A part of how that, a part of what that was all about was about a mixing up of the man and the monument when it's about statues, but also of humanity and objecthood, that the it was a return of treating people as if they were objects. And that's absolutely what was going on with the use of this skull. So it is the sawn off top, the calvaria of somebody's head, which has been lacquered and polished and fitted with a stem, which originally was a wooden stem. A bit later on, it's a silver one, like a chalice sort of effect, and there's a silver rim around the top. And when I was invited in to look at this item in 2019 by the college in order to try and understand its history, it was immediately obvious that there was a name on the name of somebody on the rim, but it was not the name of the person whose ancestral human remains were being abused and used and preserved in this way, it was the name Pitt Rivers. And that name, Pitt Rivers, was not a direct reference to the man who founded the museum in which I work, Augustus Pitt Rivers, the founder of modern archaeology, the first inspector of ancient monuments, a soldier, a theorist of sort of material culture and so on, which a lot of your listeners will be aware of. But actually, that name had been carved on at the behest of the grandson of Augustus Pitt Rivers, a man named George Pitt Rivers, who was a fascist. He was a Mosleyite who was incarcerated in the Second World War as a Nazi. And when he was released in 1945, one of the first things he did when he was allowed to get back to his college in Oxford, Worcester College, is he donated this person's body, this item, to the college and instigated a tradition of its use, of their use, of the use of this body at dessert, at first to drink wine out of, and then over the years when the chalice began to leak, it was used to hold the chocolates at dessert and passed around. And that lasted for 70 years, from 1945 until as recently as 2015. What I learned about the person, because I wanted to try to understand who this person was and what sort of intel. And it's one of those histories that you have to tell. It's a kind of archaeology way that you have to dig back through the named dead white men who are there in the record in order to try to give some degree, or to attempt to give some degree of humanity or identity to this person. The fascist sort of grandson inherited this from Augustus Pitt Rivers. He had bought it at auction at Sotheby's in London in 1884. He bought it from a man who was known as the Armourer. I go into the history of this man in the book, but he was a lawyer in central London. He was actually a graduate of Oriel College, Oxford. He was a collector. He was known as the Armourer because he was a collector, a private collector of arms, armour, and weapons of sort of punishment and torture. And his father, in turn, had been a commander in the Royal Navy. So the circumstantial evidence was a reasonably good fit with the stories that had emerged around this person's body, which was that it had been the body of an enslaved Caribbean person. In terms of anthropology, the physical anthropologist advised that this is the head of a woman. This is the skull of a grown woman, just on the form and the size of the skull. And a radiocarbon date undertaken by the college identified that it was plus or minus 18 years, sometime around 1790, 1800. So the story that this, there's also a hallmark on the silver, where which is from 1838. So it all adds up basically to a rather horrific history of an item made in the wake of abolition and emancipation out of somebody's body. It's about the use and abuse after owning human beings and the emancipation payments from which, of course, Pitt Rivers himself benefited. That there's a shift in the history of anthropology into an interest in dead ancestral remains rather than the trade and abuse and use of living people's labour. And yeah, that's the bet. But what's interesting to me, or shocking to many people, is that such a tradition, which is obviously not what you'd expect would happen in a modern Oxford, well, in any education institution, that was not only a relatively recent introduction by a fascist in 1945 or six, but also that it is something that carries on for so long. So my question really was, if that can carry on for so long, how many other things that are about who we remember and who we don't, how we think about humanity and our institutions, are able to persist without anybody even batting an eyelid?
Yeah. I think the institutional hubris of that kind of, and I think it obviously demonstrates the kind of willingness of everybody to muck in as well. It surprises me that everybody partaking in this dessert, like everybody was okay with this. And was that kind of a function of just, this is what we've always done? Or it's interesting how you've laid out, especially in the book, how much effort it took to find information about the person whose remains were being used in this way. Yeah. And I think you also reflect in the book that when we look at museums, often, especially in times of like when items are taken as loot or conquest, that it is the kind of the British white names that are distinctly associated with the items, and we really don't have any information about who actually these items at one point belonged to, or who was involved on that side. In very many ways, that kind of shapes the conversation by omission, you know? And it's interesting how we have to ask ourselves, what do we need to do to change that or make that more apparent that is happening in the first place?
Yeah, of course. And in the book, I introduce a lot of thinkers that are not necessarily normally used within archaeology, history of art, and those sorts of fields or museum studies. And that includes the work of the Jamaican theorist Sylvia Winter on forms of humanity, who gets to count as human, what she calls the history of man with a capital M. It includes the work of Sadia Hartman, Fanon, says Stuart Hall, but also Ursula Le Guin's science fiction on the rule of names, as she calls it, the power of naming. I use the Haitian anthropologist Michel Rolfe-Truelo's arguments about what he calls mentions and silences, that silences, as he argues, are not just omissions often, they are active silencings. He has this line in his book, Silencing the Past, where he says that silencing the past can be like silencing a gun. There can be, these are active reshapings of who gets remembered and who doesn't. So yeah, these are all themes that for those of us in our field, in the history of museums or monuments, archaeology, anthropology, art and architecture, we need to be thinking about and learning about who gets named and who doesn't, which is really about the forms of humanization or dehumanization, which can be in our own writing as well. So absolutely, returning the ancestors is part of that. It's incredible, for example, to say that Augustus Pitt Rivers bought this woman's skull at auction in London at Sotheby's in 1884, and that would be legal today. We still, in the UK, we have banned the sale of ivory. We have, absolutely rightly, we've banned the sale of ivory, but you can still buy and sell human remains. So that's one of several sort of campaigning strands of this book. We need to see a ban on the sale of human remains, ancestral remains in our auction houses. We also, in my view, need a new system of regulation for the many unnamed and denamed and anonymized ancestors who languish warehoused in our museum storerooms. It's one thing to learn in the restitution debate that there's so little sort of progress because there's so little transparency about what's even in the British Museum, never mind other museums across the country and across Europe and around the world. But that's even more the case, surely, when we think about the untold hundreds of thousands internationally, the millions of ancestors whose fate is to sit in cardboard boxes, like this person at Worcester College. Of course, the best I could advise the college and others could advise the college about what you do in this instance is, obviously, you don't use this at dessert anymore, but also you put this person in a cardboard box and you wrap them in acid-free and you leave them to, what, to sit forever? Is that really as the best we can do? So I'm interested in how this book might start a broader debate. I don't have the answers necessarily, but broader debate over further work on restitution, where that's possible, but also what to do where the violence was such that the names and identities and the provenance was part of what was destroyed. What should we do in those cases? We have some monuments to unknown soldiers in relation to war. What about the unnamed museum exhibits or museum specimens? How do we give some degree of humanity or dignity to them?
I think I remember researching for a podcast episode about the return of human remains, and it shocked me that the reality is that, like, with regards to providing safety and security for human remains, past a certain point, there's actually not a lot of regulation on human remains, to the point where I know Sean Graham, who's an archaeologist, has, I remember he's written a paper with other co-authors about how human remains are sold on Facebook Marketplace and how extensive that is, and the problems being that obviously the provenance of these remains is not certain, and that it honestly feels really disturbing to think that, like, on Facebook Marketplace, somebody is selling human remains. It does, it feels like a juxtaposition, but as far as I'm aware, in the like the Human Tissue Act, there's not a lot of protections for kind of like older human remains.
Yes, which, exactly. 1948 is the key date, the founding of the National Health Service. And of course, back then, the last time we had a new Labour government, and we all remembered at the time, it was so recently after what was known as the Alderhay scandal, where in Bristol, but also in Liverpool at Alderhay Hospital, there had been the retention of organs of babies and other patients who had died without consent.
Yeah.
And this was the medical profession, of course, took this seriously, and the Human Tissue Act of 2004 ensured that there was regulation, there were licenses for the retention, and there was consent, fundamentally consent, for the retention of human tissue after 1948. The museums, there was a recommendation at the time for museums to have the same kind of system and the same level of regulation. But the museums world at that time just said, look, it's complicated. We're doing our best. We're underfunded. And we'll get there in the end. So don't do it in terms of carrot, not stick for our sector. Yeah. We'll get there. It's arguable that we understand less today, 20 or 25 years on, about ancestral remains in the collections in the UK, certainly internationally, than we did at the time. And so I'm not sure that the current system is working. So absolutely, you say it's a shock about the sale of ancestors on Facebook, and that's absolutely right. It's maybe even more of a shock, I would say, that taxpayers' money is being used to warehouse ancestors with an incredibly complacent scene, which is our field. It's archaeologists, it's the bioanthropologists, it's the curators in museums, who essentially are deciding they're continuing to do exhibitions, they're continuing to do other activity in the museum. They're not prioritizing the transparency and the database building and the openness about ancestors in their collections. And surely that's got to be the top priority for every local authority museum, every university museum, every infirmary collection, not to mention our national museums.
I think to that end, these databases that they do have, especially, was it last year, the year before, when they found that one of the curators at the British Museum had been selling stuff on eBay on the side?
Yeah, exactly. So
allegedly, yes, of course. To think that wasn't picked up quite quickly, or it was like somebody, I think, allegedly had connected a PayPal account to that anonymous eBay account.
Yeah.
And it's odd that wasn't picked up as it was happening.
It's not odd, of course, because what we know is that story, I wrote about it at the time, that story was about the lack of understanding of what's in the collections. When the biggest and most powerful and best resourced museum in arguably in Europe, certainly in the UK, is able to say, we have five 1 million objects of the perhaps 8 or perhaps 9 million items in the collections on a publicly accessible database.
Yeah.
Even though, of course, if you go on to the British Museum website, that database seems to be complete. It's only about half of what they have. That's a shock. How can we still be in the point where the ballpark is like 1 million objects one way or the other?
Yeah.
So what was very good after the resignation of Hartwig Fisher, on whose watch this lack of care for collections, the basic work of them. It sounds boring to listeners that making databases or putting lists online, but how can you say that you're caring for objects? How can people indeed understand what they might want to be returned if there isn't transparency? What was good is that the interim director, Mark Jones, made the commitment that in the next 10 years there'd be a full database. Now, I don't know. That was a little while ago now. That was maybe 2 years ago now. I'd be interested to know whether they're 20% into that work, and we certainly are not seeing it yet. And I think if the British Museum aren't doing it, then how on earth are we going to expect the local authority museums or the museum trusts to be doing that work? So I do think it is absolutely essential that we have a national conversation, an international conversation about the literal skeletons in the closets.
Yeah.
The fact that it remains acceptable and legal for a skull just to be sitting in a box under somebody's desk. Mm-hmm. We're able to license firearms in our museums. There is a precedent for things being licensed, and we're able to license human tissue in hospitals now. So yeah. Why is it should not be beyond the capability of our museum sector to be open about human remains, human beings who remain in the cardboard boxes where there is no question of consent and there is no question of, and actually doing nothing, I think at this point is not acceptable. But I told the history of the Worcester College skull and the Oriel College monument in yeah. order to just try and get a more nuanced and a more theoretically informed yeah. and a wider public sort of debate about who is remembered, whose memories are erased, and how do we see our institutions as having been put to work for certain forms of racism that were not only the fake racial sciences of the 1850s, but also forms of enduring sort of cultural racism, which we see in the present. And that's about neglect of funding, about neglect of the priorities, and in some ways, ongoing abuse of ancestors in these ways.
From the point of perspective as a curator, I was wondering how true this factoid that I learned through my undergrad is. I guess it was something I'd never thought of before, but the information I saw was that museums typically on display have between maybe 1-7% of their collections on display at one time, which indicates over 90 to almost 99% are on display, and something like 80% of their collections will never be on display. Is yeah. that something that kind of sounds roughly true?
Or is no, I don't off? Think it, I don't think it's right at all. I think it's a vast underestimated factor. So we're talking much more under 1%, often 0.1%.
Oh my word.
It obviously depends what counts as an object. Yeah. If there's a whole set of archaeological sherds of a, sure. is that one, yeah. Is that Isn't one it? Vessel or is that 200? Yeah. But that's the point, actually. Think about the sherds of pottery and think about the nature of how archaeology works and how So I do think it's a separate set of questions for anthropology or world culture, archaeology museums, as compared, let's say, with art history museums, yeah. where the overall number of objects is maybe, if everything's a painting, then it's a different set of questions. But yeah, the sheer lack of knowledge, it's a form of redaction of the past. That's what I argue yeah, is actually yeah. you don't some the British were famous for burning the documents or dumping colonial records at sea, but equally efficient is to hide the artifacts that relate to the history of colonialism in a warehouse that no one even knows exists, and to not put them on a database and hide them away. And that, and who knows what is being destroyed, who knows what at taxpayers' expense is being yeah. you know, done. So this is absolutely an urgent part of the conversations for our disciplines. You know, and of course, remember, this is also in part about the legacies of knowledge. So a big part of this book is about Augustus Pitt Rivers and about the way in which he founded forms of the modern idea of the monument. He was the first inspector of ancient monuments in Britain, in England and Scotland. He based a theory of sort of material culture on his work on weapons research. And I go very much into the history of him in the Crimean War. And in Ireland in the 1860s and so on, he was very much a founder of sort of modern excavation. And I talk about his ideas of excavation and their relationship to militarism and to trauma after the Crimean War, the birth of industrial war, the turning of living landscapes into archaeological sites within, you know, within with the shells and the rifles and so on. Yeah, there's a lot more to the story that I try to tell in order to bring this home to anyone that's a practicing archaeologist, to anyone that's working in these fields intellectually, to think about what is it that we carry with us, not just what's going on with the dead in museums or with the statues in the streets, but with our own sort of bodies in the seminar rooms or on the excavation sites or walking around the galleries. How do we ourselves embody some of these histories? How do we become part of the problem? And of course, that includes me as well. It's a long reflection in this book, really, about my role as a curator in a named museum, in a legacy colonial institution, working in legacy colonial disciplines. For me, this is the only urgent question for our discipline today. We, for many years, looked at objects in museums, and we focused only on one of the two dates that are on the label in front of us. Look at an item in a museum, go later today, go to your local museum, look at the label, or look up the item on the database right now and look at the accession number, which is the date into which it came into the museum, and then the date of the object. It's from the Bronze Age, or it's from the medieval period, or it's from the 18th century. We focused for many years as our discipline on only one of those dates, which was to try and reconstruct the history of the Neolithic or the Bronze Age or the medieval or the modern periods. That secondary history, the secondary historicity, if you like, of how the museum objects were formed, that other date it came into the museum in 1900 or 1930 or 1950, they're the debates. It's a bit like the second hand is catching up with the hour hand. That form of the measurement of time is catching up with us all. So some people would say this sort of debate about imperial legacies in our disciplines or our institutions is just about trying to undo the past or judge the past on the values of the present. It's a sort of presentism. But I'd say instead, if the discipline's past is really catching up with us, that's what's happening now. We have to have our eyes open to the way in which these legacies are coming into view after being ignored for so long.
Indeed. And I think we'll be more forward-facing in our final segment. And you are listening to Modern Myth. This is the third and final segment of this podcast. We're talking about every monument will fall. And we've discussed falling statues. We've talked about how the way in which we practice archaeology can continue on those colonial legacies that kind of created archaeology in the first place. And in attempting to engage people with this kind of written history, especially when I feel like museums are almost a cultural commodity that you go to a museum to learn information from a public perspective. I wonder if there's ways in which we can change museums fundamentally that kind of get people to engage in a different way. I remember I was interviewed by somebody 4 years ago, because off the back of the Edward Colston statue thing, I was like, what is the most incendiary thing I can come up with? And I decided that the term abolish the museum was clickbaity enough, but something that I could probably defend, right?
Yeah.
Because my thinking behind that was abolish the museum in its current form. Because I studied German when I was at school. I did a bit of German. And there was a theme of two German playwrights, Bertolt Brecht and Friedrich Dürrenmatt, who wrote a type of theater called epic theater. And the idea was that Bertolt Brecht basically felt that like plays had become this kind of emotional roller coaster that sucked the audience in, and they just enjoyed it in the moment without thinking about the morals and the ideas happening behind the scene. Yeah. And so his plays were very much about alienating the audience. So The Resistible Rise of Outre is an allegory for the rise of Hitler, but the analogy is that it's a cabbage merchant mafia. There's the Caucasian cheese circle. There's the Friedrich Dürrenmatt did The Visit of the Old Lady. These are all things in which things like the actors would repeat the last line of the scene over and over again facing the audience, so that the audience would have to come out of the I'm watching, I'm consuming phase. And I really, when I think of media that I really like consuming, I like media that kind of messes with you a bit. And I don't mean just breaking the fourth wall, melting your brain kind of thing, and trying to get you out of trying to catch your attention, but in a kind of like disruptive way. And I kind of wonder, because curation is like a deliberate effort, archaeology is a deliberate effort as well. Like, we dig in a certain place, we create through destruction of like soil or stratigraphy, we create an archaeological record. That there's a way maybe of demonstrating more that museums are curated but created places, and that the curator's kind of view shapes what people see. It's not just, oh, these things go together as a type and that's just how they are functionally as like platonic objects. No, somebody's decided that these things look together or go together in a certain way. Is there an easy way for us to redo museums that kind of gets people out of the frame of just consuming what's there and taking it as a given?
Yeah, it's such an important, obviously, it's a massive question. How do you know, what do we do with, what do
yes,
you
I'm
do with the problem?
You personally responsible. You must provide the
exact
blueprint.
It's the exact blueprint for what to do. What do you do with the problem? Yeah, the Pitt Rivers Museum or like the British Museum or like the museum in general, or indeed like our allied sort of disciplines of archaeology and anthropology, or the monumental structures which they're part of. So that's the first part, I think, that this book tries to do, is to understand how the museum and the monument and knowledge have come to be put to work for things that are out of step with our times in this sort of proto-fascist period of the 1870s into the 1920s through the movement I call militarist realism. So it then becomes how to undo that infrastructure of sort of cultural whiteness, of forms of sort of cultural supremacy. But then I think we have to hold on to the idea that we've never needed something like the disciplines of archaeology and anthropology, institutions like world culture museums, forms of public memory, more than we do today, where they are able to take us out of a Eurocentric or a jingoistic or an empire nostalgic approach to how we understand the world. And we can see other ways of remembering or knowing or making or remaking the world. Of course, that's what a world culture museum should be all about. But there's a real risk in our museums that we get what in the book, I use the idea from Sarah Ahmed, the idea of non-performativity, the idea that a lot of work around sort of diversity or addressing enduring forms of racism in our institutions can involve a lot of light and heat, but no substance. So it's a lot of performance, but in order, almost in order to achieve or to change absolutely nothing. So that idea of non-performativity is there. There's also, seeing as you raise the German context, I'm not sure what I would say about the, you know, about the sort of alienation effects of the museum in a Brechtian sense, but certainly there is a very interesting term in German that I talk about in the book, which is Vorausam, which means something like anticipatory obedience. And it was used, of course, in terms of how people reacted to fascism in the 1930s, that you imagine that there's a limit on what you can do. Therefore, you're imposing your own obedience to something that doesn't even yet exist. And I think we're seeing something like that in some of the actions of our trustee bodies, of DCMS in the UK. We're seeing real leadership in some of our museums around the world in amazing ways. We're seeing restitution being moved forward. We're seeing resistance against the Trumpian cuts and attempts to re-weaponize museums. But we're also, in some cases, we need to see the leadership and the bravery that, you know, that some of those institutions have seen all over. And I think in too many institutions, we're seeing a muting or a center grounding or a balance sheeting of these conversations that misses it. So I've never been more optimistic than I am today about museums, which are beginning to make disciplines of archaeology and anthropology, which are beginning to look at the decolonial, as is art history and architecture. I've never been more positive about our memory cultures, because we're beginning to, again, it's a German term, Erinnerungskultur, memory culture. We don't talk about that much in English in the Anglophone world, but we're beginning to see that the monument, this isn't about the man, right or wrong, it's about the memory. We're beginning to see that these models of the past were designed from the outset to mix up, to confuse us about the difference between history and memory. So if somebody changes a monument or they end a practice like the abuse of human remains in a college, sometimes you're told, oh, don't cancel history. No, it isn't history, it's memory or tradition or how we wish to remember the dead. So it's incredibly optimistic, I think, as a book. Ultimately, this is a hopeful book. It's a hopeful time. But that doesn't mean that we can shy away from understanding these histories better and sometimes actively dismantling the legacies.
I think it's interesting to, especially to talk about culture war and the kind of the things that people hold to, because I feel that especially the current iteration of the culture war that you've talked about having a history, not even a prehistory, I always get the feeling that people don't, the things that people fight for in the culture war, they don't actually really care about. They care about the simulacra of the thing. They care about the symbol of the thing rather than the, you know, they don't actually care about the object or the person themselves. It feels very detached, and it also feels very opportunistic. Obviously, we've talked about, for example, Nadine Doris obviously taking away protected monument status, and it's about a single case with somebody reaching in and doing whatever they feel like and micromanaging stuff, but it always feels like there's no actual overarching desire or thing to think about. It's more about in these moments of change, it's, oh, what can I use that to prop up what I'm doing at the time? And
yeah,
I know in the book you talk in about a cultural supremacy, and a distinct from maybe the more broad lines of like racial supremacy. Although the question would be like, what really separates that other than people's plausible deniability? So, no, it's not about race, it's about culture, deflectionary tactics. What do you see is this kind of cultural supremacy? And it's almost, is it just that it's more acceptable racial supremacy, or is it distinct, do you feel?
Yeah. And so in our field, I guess I would tell the history this way, which is that from the 1850s, there was the birth of the fake racial science. It's a history that all your listeners will know, I'm sure. The racist lie that there were different species of human, and physical anthropology and our natural history museums were put to work. The London Society of Anthropology, who I talk about, and the division between the ethnologists and anthropologists in London in the 1860s was very much about this issue. And we tell the story in anthropology as if there is a great victory, which arguably there was in terms of science, that the fake science was defeated. Certainly by the time it came to 1945 and we beat the fascists, any last vestige in our textbooks or in our museums that, you know, repeated the racist lie of different species of human had entirely disappeared, and even the eugenics movement had been pushed back on. But right next door to the Natural History Museum, literally right next door to the Natural History Museum in the case of Oxford, but in many other institutions around the world, in those disciplines that were not about science, but about art and culture, in those museums about not natural history, but cultural history, those objects that have been put to work to tell precisely the same narratives about supremacy, but not using ancestral bones, but using cultural objects. And at the heart of that is the weaponization of the material culture by Pitt Rivers, who talked about the improvement of the rifle and had a militaristic, a weapons-based approach for how he saw material culture changing over time. That, as I argue in the book, was a fundamental part of how anthropology was used to tell the story that the mass slaughter in the colonial wars was simply an inevitable process of cultural supremacy, meaning that exterminations were going to happen. It's a sort of manifest destiny dimension to the thinking of sort of people like Pitt Rivers, even to the point that he imagined the English landscape as filled with the remains of what he called some great war, which was, in his view, the same war as was then being fought by his son in South Africa, as if there was these invasions of the Celts and the Romans and so forth into Britain over the years had been removing those earlier supposedly indigenous dark-skinned cultures, which he argued you could still see surviving in sort of rural Wessex or rural Ireland. That was the same process, as he said, was now happening in Africa. That this was one wave of sort of civilizational change that was based on superior material culture that led to an inevitable process of extermination and death and killing, which, as I say, removed the agency. So this is just going to happen anyway, as a way of saying, as a way of trying to say that sort of the colonial war was okay. So our museums were put to work for that, and we haven't even started, I think, to undo the work that's inherent to this. Remember, at one point in the book, I point out that it's all very well to talk about the decolonization of our reading lists, but how do you remove Pitt Rivers from the reading list when nobody reads Pitt Rivers anymore? But ideas informed by, but everyone hears about him if they're taught archaeology, and his ideas inform so many of the basic ideas that we have still. So one thing the book does is it introduces Pitt Rivers' ideas in his lectures in the 1860s, 1870s, his role, his unexpected role in things like the Indian Rebellion, his role in Hyde Park, in the Railings Affair, as a soldier. And it ties that into very much walking around the contemporary London landscape. There's a surprising amount of walking around Hyde Park that goes on in this book for your readers. Yeah, they might not have got a sense of walking from the Wellington, from the Albert Memorial to images of Cecil Rhodes and so on. So yeah, I try and bring that home as very much a part of our contemporary landscape in the present. Yeah.
Just you talking about that kind of like vision of like England as a series of like wars of conquest and everything, I feel echoes of that come up every time there's like a genetic population paper that comes out. I remember there was one about something to do with like kind of Neolithic populations within Britain, that the way the genetic markers had changed quite rapidly over a short space of time, and that was imagined as this external conquering force coming over and having this kind of like militaristic kind of takeover. I think that imagination is still there, but I wonder if that's as much a kind of, that's just because it's entrenched in this way from these kind of lessons of how it's been done before with Pitt Rivers and everybody else, that there's almost, it's just easier to slot that in because that's the way in which people see the past. And there needs to almost be other opportunities and other pigeonholes that people can put stuff in quite easily to counter that, because there's one side countering it slowly, methodically, archaeologically, but at the same time, there needs to be almost a way to kind of, I hate to use the, but optically, aesthetically, be able to give the public ways of thinking about the past that kind of is separate from what's come before, that's like culturally entrenched.
It's amazing, isn't it? But it's hard to think of any other part of the university, any other part of society, where the same narratives would be told or the same arguments would be put as those of us that work in culture, heritage, and museums have to put up with. So imagine in the case of medical science and healthcare, or the world of criminal justice, or even in a discipline like physics or biology. Imagine if you were told when it was pointed out that there was a practice or a way of thinking or a form of tradition that was hurting people, that was wrong, or that was actively hurtful, that was not something that could ever change because we've always done it that way in the criminal justice system, in healthcare. That those sort of theories of physics that we had in the 19th century, they need to be defended. Don't rewrite history, because that's what was thought back then. No. Instead, you know, the argument, you would never have such a thing in those fields, whereas in museums, sometimes you're told you can't even move an object from one sort of part of the museum to another or change the display. Sometimes in the worlds of heritage management, you're told that you can't oversee a process through which you know, one aspect of the built environment changes and another is kept. Or indeed, in terms of teaching, you're told that you can't even change the reading list without somehow cancelling Shakespeare or Jane Austen or Augustus Pitt Rivers or whoever it is this week, simply by updating a reading list. So we have to push back on of what the right wings of the culture warriors know is nonsense. They know it doesn't make any sense. Yeah. They just know it will make a good op-ed in the latest issue of the whatever right-wing sort of journal that they're writing for. And they know fundamentally that it will instigate a sort of freezing, a fear, paralysis on the part of the trustee bodies of these institutions that mean that the progressive work of change will be halted. So it's an old technique. It's one that is very much true to the history, the origins of this war on culture. So fundamentally, what Every Monument Will Fall does is it seeks to tell the history, the prehistory of this idea. Where do these ideas come from? That was the question I was faced with, really, when on every side of my working life, in the lecture theatre, out on the streets in terms of the remembrance and the debate over Cecil Rhodes, but also in the museum in terms of restitution, in every area I was told, I was hearing voices that were saying, things can never change. That's so odd, and it's so interesting, and that idea comes from somewhere. So I've tried in this book to write the history of that war on culture.
Just to round off, the one thing I also stood out to me was your mention of actually things like ChatGPT and other AI tools who would probably scrape the original kind of articles coming out about stuff that were, let's say, on one side of the culture war, but they might miss the kind of responses or not make the link to the responses that might refute or discredit those kind of messages. I find it very dangerous to me, and I wonder how widespread it is. Maybe I'm just terminally online, but the amount of people who are going to AIs for information, instead of Googling stuff, they're asking AI about something. And then I have to wonder, what are those AIs taking as good information?
Absolutely. I think it is part of the Tufton Street style culture war in its new phase, which is op-eds that are not news reports, that will misrepresent. There will be a correction in the printed edition, maybe a letter to the Times or whatever. And those things are not picked up by the AI. Because AI, one thing that AI wants to do, because that's the way it's been programmed, is to tell a history with a sort of both-sidism. On the one side, there's this. On the other side, there's that. That's actually how, of course, one can tell when an undergraduate essay has been written with AI, because it's constantly got this on the one hand, on the other hand, framing. But, of course, that's the risk, is that there's the feeding. Because there are some things that seem includes racism, that include the rights and wrongs of enslavement, that include the rights and wrongs of the treatment of a human skull at the dessert table, that will not have two sides. Even though, actually, after the Guardian story broke and the Times reported on it, a man named Dominic Sandbrook, who'll be known to some of your listeners as one half of the Rest is History podcast, other podcasts are available. I'm not sure, obviously, very good that people are listening to this one. But he wrote an op-ed saying that this was an honourable tradition on the part of the college. Surely, again, simply to show that even something as extreme as the use and abuse of a human being's body over dessert is something that could have two sides in a supposed culture war. So that's the framing to be pushed against. It's the balance sheet. It's the curate's egg account of racism, good in parts. And I go very much into that in the book. But yes, this is something that brings us right up to date. It links Augustus Pitt Rivers, FRS, a member and one of the fellows of the Royal Society, to Elon Musk, FRS, controversially remaining one of the fellows of the Royal Society. And it certainly is part of the fascist aesthetics, or the proto-fascist aesthetics of, you know, what I call militarist realism, that moves between ideas and art and culture and ideas of civilization, that finds its way through to X and to Elon Musk's ideas about civilization and to Donald Trump's images of what kind of architecture he wants to be built. And this idea that they're moving money from the National Endowment for Humanities in the United States now into building a garden of heroes of images and monuments, statues made very much in a certain art style. So the aesthetics are changing. It might be that part of the aesthetics now is that image of Donald Trump as the Pope or something. But it's certainly, as I say in the book, it's a constant playing around with what's true and what's untrue, forms of lying that can be silencing as well as speaking up, things that can become embodied. So you and your own body begin repeating them without really realizing it. And just the way in which forms of cultural supremacism live on and continue, which I'm trying to look at and think about how we disrupt in different ways.
So if people want to read this book and read more of your kind of contributions, where can they find more information about that?
Yeah, so you definitely are not going to find me on X or Twitter anymore, because it just is not a platform that I felt comfortable supporting anymore. But you can find me at Prof. Dan Hicks on Instagram, on Blue Sky, on Facebook. You can find me on LinkedIn, which actually I think is an important space these days for talking about things like heritage management and these issues. You can listen to the book as well. So I should say, I did something that I think all authors should be forced to do. I had to read out what is a relatively long book into a microphone in a very small room in sort of Birmingham for six and a half days. And so wherever you get your Audible books or your audio books, you can download me reading Every Monument Will Fall, which, yeah, if you've got a long journey ahead or if you just find it difficult to go to sleep at night, I think you might find it a useful thing to download. And then apart from that, yeah, the book is called Every Monument Will Fall, A Story of Remembering and Forgetting. It's out with Penguin internationally, and I'd encourage you to buy it from your local bookstore or your local radical bookstore rather than from the usual online merchants. I should say as well that I've got a tour coming up of UK radical bookshops that happens in the autumn. I'll be in Edinburgh, I'll be in London, I'm going to Bristol, to Nottingham, and to various other locations. And there's also a series of international dates. I'm going to be in Paris and Amsterdam and various other places. So have a look at danhicks.uk. And if you look up the talks there, you should be able to see what's going on. So hope to see some of your listeners at those events, and maybe you can come along to one of them, Tristan. I don't know if you're free. It'd be good to see you at one of the bookshop events.
Perfect. Yes, I will check my calendar for that indeed. In any case, thank you very much for talking to me today and sharing this.
Really good to be with you here. I mean, I'm actually quite fresh from having sort of talked about this book, not to a wider audience exactly, but into a microphone on my own in a tiny room in Birmingham where I recorded the whole thing as an audio book. It's something that I really think everybody that writes a book should be made to do. But if your listeners, you know, enjoy what they hear in this conversation, they can not only, you know, buy the book Every Monument Will Fall, but they can download me reading it out from Audible or from wherever you get your audio book. So hopefully, I mean, some people have actually, you know, listened to the audio book actually with the physical book in front of them, which is another way of doing it. But anyway, nice to be here to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
Now it's clear, misconception you held dear. They told you what you want to hear. Why can't you see that the truth will set you free? Expose this monolith with me.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.